Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankfort with the April 23rd, 2017 edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way on KZOX and Z, the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Next week happens to be one of those fifth Wednesdays, and so tune in then and have the opportunity then to share your takes on the world with your fellow listeners. And now on with the show. I expect that most of you, like many of your fellow Americans, breathe a sigh of relief on hearing that Steve Bannon would no longer be around to advise President Trump at the White House. That was supposed to be the week's good news. The bad news is that he wasn't shown the door because of his nationalist white supremacist sentiments, but because of a statement he made objecting to any use of force to resolve Washington's conflict with North Korea, and what was completely unheard of, his support for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from South Korea as part of a deal to defuse the current crisis between the two countries. In a phone interview with a liberal American Prospect magazine, one that he himself had initiated, Bannon, responding to a question about North Korea, told the journal's founder and co-editor Robert Kuttner that there's no military solution here. They got us. Until somebody solves the part of the equation that shows me that 10 million people in Seoul don't die in the first 30 minutes from conventional weapons, said Bannon, I don't know what you're talking about. On the day Bannon's comments were reported in the New York Times, an accompanying article cited reports that Trump was considering firing the man who is his national strategy advisor and a key player in his victory last November. Analysts in East Asia were incredulous that Bannon would suggest pulling all U.S. troops out of South Korea, said the Times, citing David Straub, a former U.S. diplomat and currently a fellow with the Sejong Institute in Seoul. The idea, he said, that anyone in the White House would even consider withdrawing U.S. forces defending South Korea if North Korea would only agree to a verifiable freeze of its current arsenal of an estimated 60 nuclear warheads is stunning, said Straub. It would be preemptive surrender to a regime whose ultimate aim is to unify the Korean Peninsula under its own terms, end quote. But there were even more important critics of Bannon, the four generals to whom President Trump has surrendered control of the country's armed forces, his new chief of staff, John Kelly, his war secretary, James Mad Dog Mattis, his national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, whom Bannon had been trying hard to oust, and head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Joseph Dunford. At the time that Bannon's remarks became public, Dunford was in Beijing meeting with the Chinese President Xi Jinping, and Mattis and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson were conferring in Washington with Japan's foreign and defense ministers. Tillerson, while acknowledging that he had read Bannon's comments, chose simply to say that Washington's diplomatic campaign must be backed up by the threat of, quote, strong military consequence if North Korea chooses wrongly, unquote. Another round of U.S. joint military exercises with South Korea, the second this year and scheduled to last 11 days, began on Monday, ostensibly aimed to prevent an attack by the North on the South. The likelihood that North Korea would invade the South is as close to non-existent as anything could be, but it didn't stop yesterday's New York Times reporting it as a fact. The possibility of a renewed conflict initiated by Washington and the long-neglected history of the wholesale destruction of that country by U.S. forces is the focus of today's program. At 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with Christine Ahn from the Korea Policy Institute about the likely impact on North Korea of the recently approved U.N. sanctions, the latest developments in the war of words between Washington and Pyongyang, and what implications President Trump's bellicose speech on Afghanistan Monday night might have for both Koreas. So stay tuned for that. Korea is called the Forgotten War, notes John DeLury, a professor in the International Relations Department at Yonsei University in Seoul. And part of what has been forgotten is the utter ruin and devastation that we rained down on the North Korean people. This has been ingrained into the North Korean psyche, he adds, which is not surprising. How bad was it? Close to President Trump's threat to hit the country with, quote, fire and fury like the world has never seen. Do you remember General Curtis LeMay, who became infamous for promising to bomb Vietnam back into the Stone Age? Well, he also played a role in North Korea's destruction. We went over there, LeMay said, and fought the war and eventually burned down every town in North Korea. Anyway, some way or another, over a period of 3 years or so, we killed off, 20% of the population. We burned down just about every city in North and South Korea, both, LeMay wrote. We killed off over 1 million civilian Koreans, end quote. Donald Boat, a chemical officer for the U.S. 8th Army, was quoted as saying that on an average good day, our pilots, quote, dropped 70,000 gallons of napalm, 45,000 from the U.S. Air Force, 10,000 to 20,000 by the Navy, and 4,000 to 5,000 by the Marines, who nicknamed the burning jellied gasoline cooking oil. In his 2013 book, Napalm, author Robert Neer noted that a total of 32,357 tons of napalm were used on Korea, about double that dropped on Japan in 1945. Moreover, more bombs were dropped on Korea than in the whole of the Pacific Theater during World War II, 635,000 tons as opposed to 503,000 tons. According to Robert Neer, Pyongyang, a city of 500,000 people before 1950, was said to have only two buildings left intact. This is still living memory in North Korea, he wrote, as was the sadism on the part of those conducting that war from Washington. If we keep on tearing the place apart, we can make it the most unpopular affair for the North Koreans, Defense Secretary Robert Lovett said after the napalm and aerial bombing campaigns of 1950 and 1951. That's according to Bruce Cummings, a University of Chicago professor who's written several books on North Korea. We ought to go right ahead, Lovett reportedly said. Dean Rusk, who would go on to become Secretary of State, recalled that the U.S. bombed, quote, everything that moved in North Korea, every brick standing on top of another, end quote. After running low on urban targets in the latter stages of the war, U.S. bombers destroyed hydroelectric and irrigation dams, flooding farmland and destroying crops. That was according to former Washington Post correspondent Blaine Hardin. It finally came to a point where Air Force commanders complained that they'd run out of targets. Charles K. Armstrong, a professor of Korean history at Columbia, would write that, quote, the physical destruction and loss in life of both sides was almost beyond comprehension, but the North suffered the greater damage due to American saturation bombing and the scorched earth policy of the retreating UN forces. Then there's a testimony of General Douglas MacArthur, the storied general from the Pacific Theater in World War II, who publicly butted heads with President Harry Truman over how the war in Korea was being conducted and ended up being relieved of his command on April 11, 1951. MacArthur had wanted to take the war across the Yalu River into China after its troops had entered the war on North Korea's behalf, and Truman, intent on keeping the war confined to the Korean Peninsula, fired him. The general subsequently testified at joint hearings before the Senate's Committee on Armed Services and Committee on Foreign Relations about his dismissal, but what he had to say about the conduct of the war has been largely excluded from history books. Here's what he said. I shrink with a horror that I cannot express in words at this continuous slaughter of men in Korea, he told the members of Congress. The war in Korea has already almost destroyed that nation of 20 million people. And he said that at a time when the war was not yet even a year old. I have never seen such devastation, he went on. I have seen, I guess, as much blood and disaster as any living man, and just curdled my stomach the last time I was there. After I looked at the wreckage and those thousands of women and children and everything, I vomited. If you go on indefinitely, you are perpetuating a slaughter such as I have never heard of in the history of mankind. End quote. The United States has never been able to truly come to terms with that havoc it wrought during that conflict, so it has chosen to forget it, an option that was never open to North Korea. Americans know the Korean War is a forgotten war, wrote Bruce Cummings, which is another way of saying that generally they do not know it. A war that killed upwards of 4 million people, 35,000 of them Americans, he notes, is remembered mainly as an odd conflict sandwiched between the good war, World War II, and the bad war, Vietnam. End quote. Nor did Washington ever consider paying reparations for the death and destruction its intervention had caused the Koreans, nor is the legality of that intervention questioned. The same would be true of our war in Vietnam that began a decade later and extended to Laos. None of those countries had ever attacked or threatened us until the recent statement by North Korean Premier Kim Jong-un following the latest round of U.N. sanctions on Pyongyang pushed by Washington. The American mindset was reflected in a recent article in the New York Times examining how Trump's predecessors had dealt with North Korea. In 1993, the Times' Russell Goldman wrote on August 17th that the North launched a missile capable of hitting Japan. Former President Jimmy Carter went to negotiate with Kim Il-sung, the North Korean leader, against the wishes of President Bill Clinton. The deal that Carter struck and Clinton would eventually agree to after Kim's death amounted to what Goldman described as a generous offer. Clinton promised to lift all sanctions, decades old, supply the North with 500,000 tons of oil a year, and provide $4 billion in aid to construct a light water reactor capable of producing nuclear energy but not weapons. In exchange for the reactor and oil, the North would end its weapons program and close but not dismantle its nuclear complex. As a result of the Republican sweeping Congress of the 1994 midterm elections, however, the oil shipments were often delayed, the sanctions remained in place, and the light water reactors never built. By 1998, according to the Times, the North had secretly restarted its weapons program with technology purchased from the Pakistani scientist A.Q. Khan, and by 2003, the agreement was completely abandoned. The lesson was an important one for North Korea, wrote the Times, Goldman. By provoking the West, the government had profited. It received several years of free oil and kept its nuclear power plant intact. The United States spent millions in aid and only briefly delayed the North weapons program, end quote. That this was hardly compensation for what the U.S. had done to North Korea a half century earlier obviously did not occur to Goldman, nor, I suspect, to the Times editors or readers. It's well to recall that serious questions remain about which side initiated the war in 1950. Listeners to my March 22nd program heard me quote from a pamphlet entitled Korea, The Lie That Led to War by Sir John Pratt, who worked for the British Foreign Service for 13 years, was an advisor on Far Eastern Affairs in the Foreign Office, and served for 2 years as head of the Far Eastern section of Britain's Ministry of Information. If you didn't hear it the first time, and since you are not likely to hear it anywhere else, it bears repeating. At dawn on Sunday, June 25, 1950, wrote Pratt, South Korean President Syngman Rhee launched a sudden attack which took the North Koreans by surprise. His forces crossed the 38th parallel at several places and captured Haiju, some miles to the north on the road to Pyongyang. The North Koreans staged a counteroffensive, and the South Koreans threw down their arms and fled. The North Koreans then drove on across the parallel and staged a full-scale invasion of South Korea. For nearly a year, wrote Pratt, both North and South Koreans had been expecting civil war to break out, and each side was confident of victory. The American Military Advisory Group, he went on, who had created the South Korean Army, were convinced that one South Korean division could defeat three North Korean divisions, and Syngman Rhee had often boasted that if they were allowed to start, his forces could capture Pyongyang, the northern capital, in 3 days. These were ludicrous miscalculations, wrote Pratt. Pratt then quoted General MacArthur speaking at the U.S. Senate hearing on May 6, cited earlier. MacArthur had said, "The South Koreans were no match for them at all, and the disposition by the South Koreans of their logistic potential was extraordinarily poor. They had put their supplies and equipment close to the 38th parallel. They hadn't developed any positions in depth. Everything between the 38th parallel and Seoul was in their area of depot," said MacArthur. "When they lost that immediate line, they lost their supplies. They," meaning the South Korean Army, "were not able, apparently, to destroy them en masse, and so that at one initial stroke, this North Korean army had a new supply base in the area between the 38th parallel and Seoul, which enabled them to press south with their full strength of their base being immediately behind them. They no longer had to rely on the long distance from the Yalu River to get their supplies down." End quote. Those are the commands of General Douglas MacArthur at the Senate's hearings 11 months into the war. One of the most telling pieces of evidence that Pratt presents was a story told by the internationally known historian and journalist John Gunther, who was in Tokyo planning to write a biography of MacArthur. On the morning of June 25th, he was dining with two officers from the U.S. occupation forces that were running Japan in the post-war period. One was called away from the table by an urgent phone message. When he returned, he passed on to his fellow officer and Gunther what the call had been about. Quote, "The South has just invaded the North," end quote. Well, that was all from a report published a year after the war began by longtime British Foreign Service official Sir John Pratt, titled Korea, the Lie That Led to War, which you can find online. This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.